Hello, this is Alton Banks from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the Triangle Business Journal. Today's program is generously underwritten by Brian Lee Funeral Homes, located in Raleigh, Garner, and Angier. They can be reached at 919-832-8225. They believe every life is unique and deserves to be honored so that every funeral is as unique and special as the person it represents. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. And so we begin our reading this hour by looking at the biz page. Quick glance at all the things going on in the Triangle. And under the heading of On the Rise comes the article, New Homes in the Vineyard Showcase Chatham Park Future. For years, the massive plans for Chatham Park near Pittsburgh have been hard to grasp. But after years of planning, the first homes are set to be unveiled. Preston Development Company is showcasing the first units on October 3rd in a residential community called The Vineyards. The event will have five new homes open as a part of the Triangle Parade of Homes. Vineyard is the first of many neighborhoods to be built over the next three decades in Chatham Park, each offering diverse housing options and attracting a broad community of residents, says Julian Bubba Rawl, co-owner of Preston Development. Homes featured in the parade include two cottages built and designed by Fresh Paint by Garman Homes and a custom home built by Pruitt Custom Homes. The park also has several homes currently underway by Upright Builders, Upton & Company, and Walker Design Build. Attendees can also participate in a public art project and see the site of the new Thales Academy and experience Knight Family Community Park. And under the heading of Nominated comes the article, Live Oak CEO Up for Coveted Seat on Banking Board. A North Carolina banking executive has been nominated for an American Bankers Association board seat. Chip Mahon, CEO of Live Oak Bankshares in Wilmington. If confirmed at the ABA annual meeting, he'll sit alongside other North Carolina executive on the board, Peter Gwaltney, head of the North Carolina Bankers Association. Mahon is one of six new nominees for the board of directors. And in a totally change of venue here on the heading of On the Market, here's the article, Want to Own a Baseball Park? You can have it, just not the team. The city of Kannapolis is selling a ballpark, but it has a catch. There's no baseball team. The Kannapolis Intimidators, named as a nod to local native Dale Earnhardt Sr., have moved to a new park downtown as part of a remarkable resurgence in the former mill town. And now, the city's looking to sell 55.46 acres that includes the old park right off Interstate 85 as office industrial space. But the park really isn't that old. It dates to 1995 and was a glitzy addition to what seemed like a dying town when it opened. But Kannapolis has benefited from Charlotte's explosive growth, and the new park is part of a $500 million investment in downtown. As for the old park, the land was appraised at $2.5 million last year. And under the heading of Campus Insight comes the article, New Survey Ranks Duke High for Free Expression. A new review of free speech at colleges gives an interesting glimpse into campuses today. The review by the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education surveyed nearly 20,000 students at 55 colleges across the country, including Duke, UNC Chapel Hill, and Wake Forest. Essentially, the survey was seeking to quantify the free exchange of ideas. The survey ranked Duke seventh overall when it came to tolerating a wide range of opinions. UNC ranked number 37 and Wake Forest number 47. The University of Chicago ranked number one. And in this time of year, the heading is Tricks and Treats. And the article is entitled, NC State Professor Weighs Concerns and Options for Halloween. The spread of COVID-19 has families wondering if Halloween will happen, and if so, if the tricks would come with dangerous tricks. Benjamin Chapman, an NC State University professor and expert in food safety, broke down the risk and says the best way to manage the risks is not participating this year. I would certainly reconsider giving our treats if I was at a high risk for severe symptoms group, he says, such as health conditions or advanced age. But for those who participate, the advice is familiar. Wear a mask, keep your distance, and clean your hands. Other tips include contactless options for handing out candy, such as individual baggies. But Chapman says that method would encourage congregation. One additional concern is that people should not spray food with disinfectants. But he says, unfortunately, there are no simple answers on this one. And finally, the last article on the biz page comes under the heading of Now Showing. Food trucks and films to keep rolling along in the triangle. Going out to the movies isn't completely a thing of the past, as a popular mix of food trucks and films now plans to keep rolling through December. The Food Truck Flicks started the first weekend of June, when five food truck owners tried to salvage some business after COVID-19 struck. In May, they were talking about ways to support each other, says Madison Mundy, event director for the nonprofit group. All the biggest food truck events were canceled, and that's our bread and butter. It's a scary prospect to think about how you will survive when the biggest things you do are all canceled, she adds. The events have generally rotated between Frontier RTP and Focus Church in Raleigh. On October 2nd, for example, The Princess Bride is playing at Frontier RTP at $25 per car. The Frontier event can hold 120 cars and usually sells out. The Focus Church can hold 210 cars and is averaging about 120 each night. There's always at least one of the food trucks at each event and a dessert truck as well. The Food Truck Flicks plans to add a downtown Raleigh location on October the 16th in a parking lot near the Red Hat Amphitheater. Mundy says other such events have popped up since the Food Truck Flicks began in June, as the idea of hanging out in your car and watching a film catches on. There's definitely been a little bit of increased competition, she says. Ticket sales have been affected, but not bad. We are still doing well. Next, we turn to the finance and technology page of this week's Triangle Business Journal. And under the heading of Transit, the article, Triangle Out for Hyperloop System. The Triangle is out of the running for Virgin Hyperloop One, the high-speed transit system that proponents say could one day reduce hours-long commutes to just minutes. Joe Malazzo, executive director of the Regional Transportation Alliance, confirms he got the official word in August. My understanding is they're focused on other states right now, he says. RTA was among the entries lobbying to get Virgin to invest in the Triangle, the Research Triangle Regional Partnership, on behalf of local players, had submitted its response to Virgin's initial request for proposals last year, and conversations were active up until last month. Virgin, which didn't respond to a request to comment, is considering multiple metros for a test track and research center for the futuristic transportation technology, just no longer Raleigh, where some had hoped it would reduce the commute to Washington, D.C. to just a half hour. Hyperloop, according to its proponents, will one day allow passengers to shoot through a tube at 671 miles per hour, reducing commute times to minutes. And under the heading of They Said It, for me, when we talk about racial equity, the goal is not just to eliminate the gap between people of color and non-people of color, but to increase the success of all groups. And this is a quote from Tracy Doakes, head of MCNC and former state chief information officer. And in the main article on the finance and technology page for this week, under the heading of Portals Open, is the article Businesses Weigh PPP Loan Forgiveness. When it comes to the Paycheck Protection Program, the Loan Forgiveness Portal is up and running at the Fidelity Bank based in Fuquay Varina. While the Small Business Administration's forgiveness process kicked off in August, many institutions, Fidelity included, delayed their participation, awaiting action that could result in automatic forgiveness for loans under $150,000. At Fidelity, CEO Mary Willis says more than 80% of the bank's PPP loans fell under that amount. So Fidelity held off, hoping for a decision from Congress to simplify forgiveness. But it is getting hung up out there so long, we decided we were going to go ahead and start taking applications, she says. In less than 2 weeks, 25% of its customers have started the process, Willis says. She guesses many are still waiting. Some experts say there may be good reason to go ahead and get your applications in. Jerry Detweiler, education director at credit building site NAV, says whether to apply now or not is a personal decision. If it looks like you're eligible for full forgiveness and it's easy enough, you can go ahead, she says. You don't have to wait and see what Congress does. But for those with questions, you may want to hold off and see what happens. It can often seem very intimidating, Detweiler says, and for businesses that have employees or have had to cut back on employee hours or pay, it can be complicated. Complicated sums up what a recent Government Accountability Office report found, that it can take upward of 15 hours to complete the forgiveness paperwork. That's part of the reason Anna Serio, certified commercial loan officer at Finder.com, advises that most business owners wait before applying for forgiveness. If you have the time to do it now, if you really need to do it now, it's worth the attempt. But you really could get more if you can wait, she says. Next, we turn our attention to the real estate page of this week's Triangle Business Journal. And under the heading of apartments comes the article, California Developer Plots Expansion for Cary Community. A West Coast developer plans to expand an aging apartment complex in Cary by adding dozens of new units to the existing community. Earlier this month, investment firm Avanath Capital of Irvine, California, filed plans to add 43 new townhome-style apartments to the Arbors at Cary Apartments, an affordable multifamily community. The property is situated south of downtown on nearly 17 acres at 200 Wren Drive near the Saltbox Village Shopping Center, which sold last year. Altogether, the Arbors currently features 248 units across a collection of three-story buildings. The property opened in 1971 and was renovated in 2011. The portion of the site labeled for redevelopment features 76 apartments across three buildings with 12 units each and five buildings with 8 units each. The new units would bring the total count to 119. No timeline or pricing for the future apartments was available. Current rental rates at the Arbors range from $808 per month for a one-bedroom apartment to $1,177 per month for a two-bedroom unit, according to Apartments.com. And under the heading of Virginia Buyer, the article, Apartments Near Crabtree Are Sold. A Virginia investor spent nearly $50 million on a recently opened apartment community by the Crabtree Valley Mall. An affiliate of Stony Point Development paid $49.5 million for the Crabtree Lakeside Apartments, featuring 221 units that opened last year. The apartments are situated on 15 acres at 5500 Home Valley Drive, across the street from the Mark at Crabtree Apartments. The apartments feature a collection of one- and two-bedroom units with amenities, such as a pool, fitness center, yoga studio, and more. Rental rates at Crabtree Lakeside range from as low as $1,204 per month for a one-bedroom unit to as high as $1,739 per month for a two-bedroom unit, according to Apartments.com. The seller, Dominion Realty Partners, finished developing the apartments last year at a cost of around $40 million. Dominion purchased the land for $6.2 million from trustees of the Dorothy R. Kerr Revocable Trust. Kerr was a Wilson native who, with her husband, Banks, founded the Kerr drug chain. And under the heading of Southwest Durham, high-end apartments sold for $80.2 million. A new high-end apartment community in Southwest Durham changed hands recently in a sale that topped $80 million. Duck Pond Realty paid $80.2 million for what's now called Reserve at Patterson Place, an upscale apartment community complete with 345 units located between downtown Durham and Chapel Hill. The seller, Terwilliger Pappas, bought the land for $7.2 million in 2018 and completed construction on the property last year. The apartments feature a mix of studio, one, two, and three-bedroom units, plus amenities such as a pool, fitness center, dog park, and playground. Rental rates range from $1,176 for a studio apartment to as high as $2,824 for a three-bedroom unit, according to Apartments.com. Newmark Knight Frank, Vice Chairman Sean Wood, Dean Smith, and John Heimberger, Senior Managing Director Alex Okolsky, and Managing Directors John Monroe and Jason Kahn represented the seller. And finally, on our page comes the article, College Towns Hotels Brace for Hit. Gone are the tailgate parties, packed stadiums, and hordes of color-coordinated fans synonymous with college football. And so, too, is the lifeblood of thousands of local hotels that depend on those crowds around game days. A new analysis by DBRS Morningstar identified $3.98 billion in mortgage debt backed by 141 hotels within a five-mile radius of so-called Power Five football schools, which on average drew 58,500 fans per home game in 2019. Of those 141 hotels, the study cited nine in the Triangle near NC State University, UNC Chapel Hill, and Duke University. While some of the 65 schools within that group, all members of the Big Ten, Atlantic Coast, Big 12, Pacific 12, or Southeastern Conferences, have allowed limited fan capacity for home games during the COVID-19 pandemic, many will play to empty stadiums and with reduced schedules. In North Carolina, Governor Roy Cooper is allowing outdoor stadiums that seat 10,000 or more to reach 7% capacity beginning October 2nd. This season will see far fewer than the 25.6 million fans who attended Power Five home games in 2019. The downturn presents significant financial implications for college towns already under financial pressure due to the economic toll on businesses and campus operations. For many hotels, the lack of game day traffic is nothing short of a crisis for survival. People aren't coming to college towns to the football games, and they are not going out to bars. They aren't drinking, not going to restaurants, and not shopping, says Stephen Jelinek, an analyst at DBRS Morningside. There are going to be secondary effects on the economy in college towns, especially those in secondary markets that are overly reliant on weekend football. Next, we turn to the healthcare higher ed page of this week's Triangle Business Journal, and there we find several articles. Under the heading of Promising comes the article, Researchers See New Options in Treatment of Lung Cancer. Researchers at the UNC Lineberger Comprehensive Cancer Center says they found a new vulnerability and a common form of lung cancer that could provide a promising target for a new therapeutic. They recently published new research in the journal Cancer Research that shows the potential to target a specific RNA to attack lung squamous cell cancer. Cancer is revealing at a rapid pace that it has many more vulnerabilities than we previously believed, which undoubtedly means better treatment options ahead, says Dr. Chad Peacott of the UNC School of Medicine and the senior author. I'm very hopeful, based on our work and much of what's being done in the field of drug development, that many new medicines are on the horizon. And under the heading of clinical trial comes the article, New Muscular Disease Drug is Proving Effective. A new drug meant to treat a muscular disease is showing promising results, according to researchers at Duke Hospital. Interim results from a 24-month clinical trial on the new drug for boys with Duchenne muscular dystrophy, the progressive neuromuscular disease, were recently released, suggesting that the drug may retain or improve the effects of current steroid treatments. This is potentially great news for these boys who are just beginning the steroid regimen that is our standard of care treatment, said Dr. Edward Smith, the co-director of the Duke Children's Neuromuscular Program. Duke Health is one of the sites conducting the trial. And under the heading of Going Remote comes the article, DCRI launches milestone clinical trial to attack lupus. Duke Clinical Research Institute, also known as DCRI, has launched the first direct-to-family decentralized clinical trial, a milestone in the movement of the clinical research industry toward more remote, less in-person trials that has been accelerated by the demands of COVID-19. Called iPersonal, which is a big acronym for Individual Patient Exposure and Response in Pediatric Lupus, the trial will work to determine the most effective dose of hydroxychloroquine for children and teens with lupus. But in addition to finding ways to help those suffering from the disease, the trial will also pave new ground in finding ways to make decentralized remote trials more effective. Not only does the study use an exciting new model of clinical research, but it's also answering important questions for pediatric patients with lupus, says Dr. Barry Stephen Balovic, a Duke professor of pediatrics and co-principal investigator for the study. Although hydroxychloroquine is the most commonly prescribed drug to patients with lupus, it's never been studied in children to understand the optimal dose needed to reduce lupus disease activity. The study will be conducted by recruiting 20 children and teens with lupus using the CARRA registry. This is the largest registry that collects clinical and patient-reported information about children and adolescents with pediatric-onset rheumatic diseases. In addition to using remote enrollment, the study will also use a variety of mobile technologies, such as smartphone apps and wearable technology, to monitor activity and survey completion. The researchers will also test a digital pill bottle, which, in addition to using audio and visual reminders to entice patients to take drugs, regularly can also catalog adherence by providing researchers data about when it is opened. And finally, on the healthcare higher ed page in this week's TBJ, under the heading of Bed Battle, comes the article, Healthcare Leaders Seek More Space. Even as the Triangle's large health systems continue to face the pandemic and the resulting financial losses, they're competing with one another for expansion opportunities in Wake County. According to recent applications submitted to the NC Department of Health and Human Services, Duke Health, UNC Health, and Wake Med Health and Hospitals are all looking to expand their operating room capacity. The 2020 State Medical Facilities Plan projects the county will need three more operating rooms for Wake County in 2022. Duke Health has proposed adding up to 2 operating rooms to its existing Green Level project in West Cary, which would give it a total of 3 operating rooms. If approved, the project is estimated to cost $6 million. In addition to the application, Duke also proposed building a new ambulatory surgical center in Garner with no more than 1 operating room and 2 procedure rooms. The system estimated the project would cost about $11.7 million. Rex is also applying for all 3 operating rooms. The system seeks to add 1 operating room to its Raleigh hospital, which would give the hospital 32 operating rooms at a total cost of $407,588. It is also applying to build an orthopedic surgery center in Garner with 2 operating rooms and 2 procedure rooms at a total cost of $14 million. A UNC Rex spokesman said the center will be a joint operation with Raleigh Orthopedic, similar to the facility it has off Edwards Mill Road. Wake Med is applying to add 1 operating room to its Cary Hospital, which would leave it with 13 operating rooms in total. The system estimates the expansion would cost $2.2 million, according to its CON application. Next, we turn to a brief article on the news page under the heading of Pandemic Impact. Some RDU restaurants could be closed for good. The pandemic may have permanently claimed 7 restaurants at Raleigh-Durham International Airport. While 13 of RDU's restaurants are back up and running, the airport confirms some vendors currently aren't planning to come back, including Bond Brothers Beer Company, which had been open less than a year. Cary-based Bond Brothers took over its terminal spot from Gordon Biersch and had planned for at least a 16-month stint, starting last January. It was part of RDU's plan to highlight offerings with a local connection, one that would reflect the Triangle community, airport officials said last year. Others that are expected to be closed permanently include Wow Bowl, Rush Bowls, Cantina Grill, California Pizza Kitchen, Deli and Company, and Camden Food Company. But all might not be lost for Bond Brothers. Whit Baker, co-founder of Bond Brothers, says the company is looking for another management team to allow it to stay on at RDU. In Terminal 2, Bond Brothers had been working with Areas USA out of Miami. It had signed over the rights to its brand in the space and sold the firm wholesale beer. But amid the pandemic, Areas pulled out, shutting down multiple concepts in the terminal. If another vendor, such as HMS Holdings, took over, they could just put us right back in, Baker says. We're talking to those people, he says. During its brief tenure at Terminal 2, Baker says the firm saw a lot of success. We sold about 60 barrels of beer over the course of 3 months, January, February, and mid-March, he says. We did great. Hope to be back in there. Hope to see what happens. Most of the permanently impacted restaurants, at least so far, involve RDU's relatively new contract with Areas USA. RDU signed a short-term contract with Areas in October of last year to freshen its options. Next, we turn to the cover story for this week's Triangle Business Journal, and it's entitled Hotels Hope and Hold On as Bookings Lag. 9 months ago, the Triangle's hospitality industry was gearing up for a banner year. Several hotels had recently opened, and new plans poured in for additional space in a market with a dearth of hotel rooms. The first 3 months of 2020 saw the opening of the Longleaf Hotel in Raleigh, and the city released a request for information, that's an RFI, to bring a massive downtown hotel to Fayetteville Street. Origin Hotel opened in Raleigh in July after a brief delay due to COVID-19. Raleigh was definitely positioned for adding quite a few hotels and room nights to the area, probably to the point we'd tell you it was aggressive growth of new inventory coming into the Raleigh market, says Matt McClellan, executive VP at Raleigh's Concord Hospitality. It was very dangerous, borderline, it was very aggressive, rather, I beg your pardon, borderline getting dangerous. But by March, the picture changed as events and conferences around the country were put on hold. Soon, stay-at-home orders had anyone who could work from home and companies freezing travel plans. Occupancy rates have crashed, and some of the Triangle's best-known hotels have landed on industry watch lists for distressed properties. In Wake County, occupancy rates plummeted to just 27.5% in April. In Durham, April occupancy hit 29.7%, down from 77.5% the year before. "We were obviously decimated by COVID-19, says Lynn Mingus, the president and CEO of the North Carolina Restaurant and Lodging Association. "This has been a challenge since the beginning." In Wake County alone, hotel lodging tax collections through July are down $8.8 million or 50.1% over last year, according to a report by Visit Raleigh. Meanwhile, 258 conventions, meetings, and group sporting events have been canceled, totaling $124.5 million in economic impact. 35 conventions, meetings, and group sporting events were rescheduled, totaling $20.5 million in economic impact. And at least 117 large-scale events and festivals were canceled or rescheduled. Amid the turmoil, the city of Raleigh canceled the RFI for the new hotel, among other projects, amid the shortfall, and area tourism and hospitality organizations such as Visit Raleigh and Discover Durham scrambled to work with local leaders and hoteliers to find support wherever they could. Across the Triangle, hotels began suspending operations and laying off or furloughing employees. "We've been in the hotel business in the Triangle for 4 decades, and I've never seen anything like this before," says Sean Chabra, president of CMC Hotels, based in Cary. "It's obviously a difficult time, not just for hotel operators, but for bars and restaurants, gyms and movie theaters, music venues, and so many other businesses. We're all having to adjust." As all this was happening on the consumer side, hotel owners found it harder to make their mortgage payments as revenue plummeted. By May, the number of properties in the Triangle placed on the commercial mortgage-backed securities, that's the CMBS watch list, more than doubled to 58, up from 22 in April. The number was just 13 in March. CMBS debt has become an increasingly popular way to finance developments and investments in properties, such as hotels across the country. The downside is that the loans are typically controlled by a collection of owners, making negotiations much more difficult than traditional loans through banks and other institutions. In the past, defaulted payments on CMBS loans could often result in foreclosure. Fortunately, as business inched its way back and borrowers negotiated with lenders, the number of watch-listed properties began to recede. In the Triangle, June saw a dip down to 52 properties watch-listed, and by August, data firm TREP reported that delinquency rates were dropping across the country. But for companies that were unable to get out of delinquency, lenders have increasingly turned to special servicers to begin working with property owners. Special servicing rates jumped to over 10% in August, up from 3.2% last year. And today, a number of large Triangle hotels have missed or defaulted on CMBS debt payments, with some entering special servicing. Financial filings show that many include an increasingly popular refrain in watch list commentaries, quote, "borrower has notified master servicer of COVID-19 related hardships," quote. The largest of these is the Sheraton Raleigh, a 353-room hotel built in 1982 in the heart of downtown Raleigh. The property still owes payments as far back as April. PM Hotel Group, which manages the hotel, did not return requests for comment. On August the 4th, the company's lender sent the loan to special servicing because of a payment default. According to financial filings, files are being reviewed to determine workout strategy going forward. The next largest on the list is the Marriott Research Triangle Park. That property has also run into trouble making CMBS loan payments and saw its loan mature earlier this year with a balance still outstanding. That happened in June, and according to August filings, those loans are still non-performing. A special servicer has begun reviewing that property as well, which also appears to owe payments from April. The special servicer is in the process of reviewing information and awaiting requested information from the borrower, says financial filings dated August 17. Other hotels 60 days delinquent on payments or more include the Hilton Garden Inn, Raleigh-Durham Airport, Homewood Suites Cary, Aloft, Chapel Hill, and others, according to filings. None of these hotels return requests for comment. One of the cash sources keeping hotels afloat is government aid programs, though industry experts say that help is running out and more is needed to stave off a crisis. The NCRLA's Mingus says programs like PPP and others have helped hotels keep employees and stay on their feet for now. We're watching the PPP run out. Most of our members are running out, and we're facing a real crisis if we don't get some relief, Mingus says. If we don't really receive another round here, we're going to see these job losses mount significantly. Another program recently proposed is the Helping Open Properties Endeavor, or HOPE Act. That legislation was introduced earlier this year and looks to provide relief to hotels and their owners struggling to make payments on CMBS debts. It would provide borrowers with some financial assistance. The challenges are most hotels are financed this way, and 24% across the country are already delinquent, Mingus says. Without some relief, they're not making mortgage payments. They don't have revenue coming in. Without relief, these mortgages are going to fall into foreclosures. Even aside from additional funding, one thing hoteliers say is crucial to bringing back travelers is more consistency in the rules. Without that, travelers coming for an event or meeting may not even know if they'll be able to hold it by the time they arrive. The rules of engagement change as we speak, McClellan says. The hardest part is, how do we book our business meeting when we book it today and we come to Raleigh and all the rules of engagement have changed? Now our meeting size has changed and restricted. Since the spring, occupancy has slowly improved, but nowhere near enough to get area hotels back on track. On the hotel side, they were allowed to remain open during COVID, but we were much more optimistic, Mingus says. But today, they are operating at around 40% occupancy. That's devastating. The average daily rate is down, and they're discounting the price of the rooms they're selling. In Wake County, August closed out with a 40% occupancy after hitting a 47% peak in the first week. In Durham, August occupancy hit 43.1%, down from 73% in 2019. That's up from the sub-30% occupancy rates from earlier this year, but it's still a far cry from last year's upper 70s. After the enormous cliff we went over in March and April, it's been a very slow recovery, and no one knows exactly what to expect, says Susan Amy, president and CEO of Discover Durham. It's coming back really slowly. Meanwhile, Amy says, September and October have historically been some of the busiest months, with sports, events, and conferences all bringing tons of travelers to the region. This year, almost all of that has been canceled. Throughout the pandemic, hotels have done what they can to keep sales and management staff developing business and maintaining properties, preparing for a rebound. At Concord, the company has kept sales teams and management staff on to maintain the business pipeline as much as possible and to keep the facilities running smoothly. The best way to plan forward and be prepared is not to cut so deep you hit the muscle, And that's what we did, McClellan says. Stay focused on selling and keeping the facility ready for the consumer when they get back. Meanwhile, developers continue filing plans to bring new hotels to the region. Just last month, North Carolina hotelier First Carolina Management, that's known as FCM, closed on two properties in Garner for the site of a future 110-room Spring Hills Suites by Marriott Hotel. CMC Hotels says it continues to be bullish on the region and is moving ahead with plans for a pair of major hotel projects in Cary and Briar Creek. We are proceeding with the development of two major hotel projects in the Triangle, a 10-story Westin at Briar Creek and a Courtyard by Marriott off Walnut Street in Cary. Chabra says both hotels will open next year. And at Concord Hospitality, the company has six projects in the works across the country. In the Triangle, it's contracted to work on the development of at least one downtown hotel. On the event side, organizers and hotels are banking on a strong resurgence in 2021 after this year was essentially a bust. But that likely won't happen until the second half of 2021. We're still very optimistic that once we can get this behind us, a lot of that momentum will pick up, says Dennis Edwards, president and CEO of the Greater Raleigh Convention and Visitors Bureau. We're still getting a lot of inquiries about event planners and organizers for mid-2021 and beyond. Corporate travel likely won't pick up until companies bring back employees from a largely remote schedule, Edwards says, and that's unlikely to happen until later next year. Meanwhile, hotels are learning to do more with less, as remaining employees taking on new responsibilities to do what they can to keep the business running as smoothly as possible. Less business means companies have had to make cuts, oftentimes shifting former employees' responsibilities onto those that remain. We had to get creative with what a position at a hotel means. Everyone had to become what I'd call a utility player, McClellan says. It's become typical for a manager of sales to be working at the front desk and doing their sales call internally in the lobby. General managers volunteered to bring in their lawnmowers from home and help mow the lawn. Today, the big question remains when COVID-19 will be sufficiently under control. We believe in Raleigh. Raleigh's home, McClellan says. We love it, and it's going to bounce back just fine, but it's going to take a vaccine to do it. In Wake County, Visit Raleigh is kicking off marketing campaigns to attract customers to area hotels, restaurants, and attractions while emphasizing the measures businesses are taking to keep consumers safe. In Durham, the company and the county and its partners have launched the Back on the Bowl campaign to showcase the efforts and resources available to get the region back on its feet. McClellan says they're still waiting for the day when travelers regain the confidence to travel, and he expects a boom in business when that happens. The real challenge is going to be a vaccine that all of us as citizens believe in, that we can trust that science is behind, that it's safe and effective, he says. When that confidence changes, the world is going to travel like it never has before. This week's executive voice belongs to Brent Sigman. Armed with a professional engineering degree, an MBA, and 20 years of experience in the HVAC industry, Brent Sigman now heads Comfort Mechanical Contractors. As president of the Durham company, Sigman leads the strategic direction and day-to-day operations of the business. The 100-person firm now specializes in new HVAC commercial construction and renovation, engineering HVAC design, build, and HVAC service controls. So tell us about the firm. The company started out in 1955 as Comfort Engineers. Three former employees purchased the company and changed the name to Comfort Mechanical Contractors in 2016. We currently have about 100 full-time employees in the Triangle. There are three owners, including Jamie Hagler, Vice President of Operations, and Robert Knott, Chief Financial Officer. We offer a full design build service or systems designed by other engineering firms for commercial HVAC projects. We manufacture ductwork with capability to create various ductwork and materials. We have a complete service group with factory-trained technicians to keep the HV systems operating and serviced. We also have a controls division that allows us to install and service full building automation systems. How long have you been with the company? I was with the company back in the early 2000s for about 5 years. I resigned to go back to graduate school for an MBA. After completing that, I went to work for Carrier Corporation as a product manager in the marketing group. Holding various management positions for about 10 years, I was contacted by some former co-workers at Comfort Engineers. They told me the opportunity of purchasing the company. I still had a very high regard for the owners at CE, and I just felt like it was a good fit for both of us. The transition was one of a steep learning curve at the beginning, but it was a fun time. I attribute the smooth transition to the employees. They truly are an amazing group of people. How's the pandemic affected your business? Well, we're very fortunate to be classified as essential employees, so we've been continuously open. The landscape at job sites was constantly changing as the recommended PPE changed as we learned more. I must express how courageous our employees are by working with the unknown of the virus. It's also difficult to social distance when you require multiple people to hang large equipment, materials, etc. For the office, we ordered laptops for anyone that did not have one and offered work-from-home options. The other immense pressure comes from pressures surrounding work. Many of the employees have children in school or preschool, including myself, so I see the issues firsthand. When the school shut down, it imposed a reactive management style at CMC to keep people working and properly support employees' families with changing personal schedules. Describe your management style. I would probably say accountable is the best term. To quote one of the best management group books, which is How to Win Friends and Influence People by Dale Carnegie, he says, be hearty in your approbation and lavish in your praise. I try to focus on the 5,000 things you are doing well, not the one thing that could be better. As we approach the end of the broadcast, we turn to the viewpoint page of this week's TBJ. And as you know, there's usually a guest column here. And this week's guest column is written by John Hood, chairman of the John Locke Foundation in Raleigh. And his article is entitled, North Carolina's Economic Recovery is Sputtering. According to the latest jobs report, North Carolina's headline unemployment rate fell to 6.5% in August, down from 8.5% in July. Good news, we're celebrating, right? Well, don't pop the cork on that champagne just yet. This was mostly a statistical artifact, not a major improvement in the state's labor market. While the government counted about 100,000 fewer North Carolinians as unemployed last month, only 28,000 got jobs. The remaining 72,000 dropped out of the labor force. In other words, they either gave up looking for a job in North Carolina or left the state. In a healthy economic recovery, your labor force should be growing, not shrinking. Indeed, according to other measures, North Carolina is experiencing the worst economic recovery in the southeastern United States. Let's begin with the issue I just referenced, labor force participation. In February, 61.6% of North Carolinians at least 16 years of age and not living in some kind of institution were participating in the labor force. That is, they were either employed or actively looking for a job. In August, that rate was 57.5%. North Carolina's labor force participation is down 3.9 percentage points. The other 11 states in the southeast all had smaller declines. The regional average dropped by just 1.5 points. Now, let's look at employment itself. Unlike the unemployment and participation rate statistics, the government's job count comes from a survey of employers, not households. This survey has a much larger sample size and produces more stable results. Unfortunately, it doesn't paint a rosier picture of our state's labor market recovery to date. In August, North Carolina employers reported 4.3 million filled positions. That comes to about 350,000 fewer jobs than in February before the onset of the COVID-19 recession, a drop of 7.6% in total employment. Again, that's the worst performance in the Southeast. The next hardest hit state, Louisiana, experienced a 7% decline during the same period. Among our neighbors, employment fell 6.1% in Virginia, 5.6% in South Carolina, 5.4% in Tennessee, 4.7% in Georgia. Want to broaden our perspective beyond the labor market to take in the rest of the state's economy? Unfortunately, the resulting picture has a built-in time lag. The most recent measure of gross domestic product by state was for the first quarter of 2020, which includes only the initial month of COVID impact, which was March. With that caveat in mind, however, our state performance still lags the regional average, although not by as much. North Carolina GDP fell 5.1% during the first quarter. That's worse than Georgia with 4.7%, South Carolina with 4.8%, Virginia with 3.8%, and the Southeast as a whole 5%, but better than Tennessee's 6.2% drop. Perhaps the next wave of economic reports will be more positive. Perhaps North Carolina's second quarter GDP growth will turn out much better. Perhaps our labor markets will look much healthier by October or November than they do right now. Taking an accurate temperature of any economy is always a challenging task, and COVID has made it more so in a number of ways. So we should always be open to the possibility that employment and GDP statistics will undergo significant revisions in the future. Right now, though, based on the available evidence, it would be fair to say that North Carolina's economic recovery is sputtering. Thousands of North Carolinians are finding new jobs every month, to be sure. But thousands more, frustrated, depressed, angry, are being left behind. For some, their employers are their own small businesses, have gone bankrupt. Others have intact employers, but face with school closures, or having to cut back their hours at work, or leave their jobs altogether so they can stay home with their young children. And some are exiting the state in search of better opportunities elsewhere in the region. As we are in the middle of election season, you are, of course, free to draw whatever political conclusions you like. But first, please give just a thought and say a prayer for the North Carolinians who are suffering. This week's editor's notebook is entitled COVID-19 is Making the Future of Retail Unrecognizable. During fall and winter, retailers benefit immensely as consumer spending shoots up dramatically. This year, however, may be different. According to Giant, BDO came out with its first half 2020 retail bankruptcies and store closures report just a few days ago, and the numbers reflect similar patterns as it did in 2010, when the country was in the middle of the Great Recession. It's true that the virtual environment has been profitable for certain retailers, such as electronics and computer equipment and service vendors, but it has rocked the apparel, hotel, restaurant industry, and almost every consumer-facing shop. From January through mid-August, BDA estimates there have been more store closing announcements than the entire 12 months in 2019. BDO mentions research group eMarketer's projections of a 10.5% decline in retail sales in 2020, with bricks and mortar sales decreasing 14%. But eMarketer also notes that e-commerce sales will increase by 18% in 2020, offsetting some of the brick and mortar losses. So what will retail look like in the future? For retailers to be successful, they have to concentrate on two elements of their business, e-commerce and marketing. Smaller boutique retailers have to invest in supporting a robust e-commerce platform and let consumers know their virtual store is easy to use, convenient, and full of deals. If retailers simply invest in technology but not marketing, they likely will suffer because competitors will do everything to take business away. Then there are the malls. The closings of Anchor and other stores and shopping malls will likely make visits to them less appealing and depress mall traffic overall, unless landlords are able to quickly fill these vacancies with attractive alternatives, notes BDO's analysis. In the end, the country's economic conditions will determine the future trajectory of the retail industry. In the past 6 months, more than 60 million Americans have filed for unemployment insurance. That's more than the number of claims filed during the 18-month Great Recession. If corporations such as Disney, Dell, Citigroup, Ford Motor Company, and scores of others keep laying off or furloughing thousands of workers, no amount of convenience will make consumers spend money on discretionary items. The downstream effect on retail is going to be felt by state and local governments across the country that collect the sales taxes. That in turn will have a ripple effect on funding schools, colleges, police, and healthcare services. For a full economic recovery, look at retail. If retail comes back, so does the country. And included with this is a chart entitled Close-ups and it Closeouts, and it has 29 retail bankruptcy filings in 2020. In apparel and footwear, there were 10, in home furnishings, 5, in department stores, 3, and all others, 11, for a total of 29 filings. So the store closings percentage is apparel, footwear, 39%, home furnishings, 24%, department stores, 15%, all others, 22%. And finally, this week's business survey, Pulse, asks the question, is your company doing enough to support diversity in the workplace? Of 107 responses, 51% said yes. 29% said no, but we're making efforts to improve, and 20% said no. Well, that music means we've run out of time for today's episode of the Triangle Business Journal. I hope you enjoyed it. Be sure to listen next time. I'm Alton Banks, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. Today's program is generously underwritten by Brian Lee Funeral Homes, located in Raleigh, Garner, and Anger. They can be reached at 919-832-8225. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. So long till next time.